Okay, the next matter on the call today is Picard, P-I-C-A-R-D versus PNC Group 1. That's case number 18-0207. Counsel, if you would please approach. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Please.
Your Honors, my name is Jessica Volker. I represent the appellants, PNC Group, and the Hartford in a workers' compensation decision entered by the trial court addressing the issue of apportionment. I'd like to spend the majority of my time addressing those issues that were outlined in the brief, and then if I have some time, I'd like to address the penalty issue. Essentially, the court declined to issue or to apply apportionment in this case between two distinct separate injuries suffered by the injured employee with the same employer, and the trial court cited two reasons for declining to apply apportionment in this case. First, that apportionment didn't apply because the injured employee had suffered injury to two separate body parts. I think that was error on the part of the trial court, because what we have here is two scheduled member injuries that occurred in 2012. And under Nebraska Revised Statute 48.121 sub 3, which was amended in 2007, if in the court's discretion a injured employee suffers two scheduled member injuries arising out of the same accident and meets the minimum threshold of 30% loss of earning power, that case then can be addressed as a loss of earning power case, which is essentially a whole body injury. And the second injury suffered by this employee in this case in 2015 was a back injury. So essentially those are the same injuries. It's a whole body injury and another whole body injury. Whole body injuries are distinct from scheduled member injuries under the Nebraska Workers' Compensation System because whole body injuries are paid out based on a loss of earning power. A loss of earning power is different than a scheduled member as it analyzes factors such as the ability to procure employment in the labor market, wages lost, educational level, and those sorts of factors. So really what we have here are two of the same body parts, and I think the court erred in finding that two risks arising out of the same accident, whole body injuries, and a lumbar spine injury, a whole body injury, were not the same injury. Secondly, the court declined to apply apportionment in this case because the Martinez-Navarro case guides the court and indicates that if there is a disability or apportionment only applies if the first disability was previously compensated. This case was a consolidated case. So we have a 2012 injury and we have a 2015 injury. The 2012 injury was tried at the same time as the 2015 injury. The 2012 injury, she was ordered at 75% loss of earning power. So essentially, once you have that court order that she is to be paid, that's tantamount to payment. I don't know anything that couldn't be the same thing as payment. And by the trial court indicating that she hadn't been paid as an exclusionary factor in not applying apportionment really circumvents the whole purpose of apportionment. Apportionment is meant to prevent double recovery. If someone has an injury and that injury continues to act as a source ability at the time of the second injury, that's to prevent double recovery from the first injury that still continues to act as that source of disability versus the second injury. And
so,
here,
counsel, let me just stop you for a second there, because so if an employee is injured and she has a loss earning capacity of 75%, then she sustains another whole body injury and she's sustains a loss of earning capacity of 25%. That, and assuming they're separate employers, does that second employer get off the hook?
That second employer doesn't get off the hook, but if that second employer accommodates that person because that person has a disability that's acting as a source of disability at the time of the second injury, then apportionment should apply so that double recovery doesn't come into effect for that claimant. What we have in this case is we have a claimant who was 75% disabled and then assessed a 55% disability. So what we have is someone who's effectively on the books 130% disabled, which for all practical purposes doesn't make any sense. And she remains employed with this employer and is able to again file further complaints, further injuries, and if apportionment doesn't apply, then there's no end. I mean, at least if she were 100% disabled, that would be the finite result for this person. But because apportionment didn't apply, she's got a 75% and then a 55% and then potentially another disability. And I think some of the facts in this case that are important are the fact that at the time of the first injury, she was assigned permanent restrictions of no lifting over 10 pounds. The employer accommodated those restrictions and put her in a full-duty bid job that didn't require any further accommodation in that job. It was just a job that didn't require.
Let me stop you for a second. What makes you say that you would aggregate 75% and the 55% and have more than 100% listed? Don't you think that she looked at the 2015 back injury separately and said, with this back injury, this would be your loss earning capacity, as opposed to the 2012 with your wrist, this is your loss earning capacity? Meaning the 2012, what, there was a 10-pound lifting restriction.
Correct.
The 2015, there was a 5-pound lifting restriction. The 2015, a 10-pound lifting restriction. So it seemed to me what she was suggesting is looking at these independently and saying, this would be your loss earning capacity from this, this would be your loss earning capacity from that. Is there anything in the record that would suggest otherwise?
I think that's what she did, and I think that's what the error was, because if you have an injury that continues to act as a source of disability, you shouldn't apply those in a vacuum. What you should do is...
But didn't the court in Martinez say that's exactly how you factor it? You look at these independently, and if apportionment is appropriate, then you simply subtract the second from the first?
I don't think that's what Martinez said. I think what Martinez said, well, first of all, I think Martinez is distinguishable because Martinez is two separate body parts. So Martinez was a shoulder and a whole body.
Right.
And I think that's the distinction there, is that you cannot apply, give credit for a scheduled member injury, which is a shoulder, against a
whole body.
Right,
that's just like Jacobs. But aside from that, this court also talked about, but even if, right? And then they went on and talked about, if you were to do this right, the way you apportion, you look at these separately and look what the earning capacity would be, or the diminution in earning capacity as to each injury, and then if apportionment's appropriate, you do the math. Isn't that what this court said?
I'm not sure that that's what she said, but even in effect, if the trial court did that, it was erroneous, because if she has a 75% loss of earning power and then injures herself and is assigned restrictions that are less than those restrictions, that the...
That's really odd by itself.
Appellee herself testifies, I need it up until the day of the injury.
How do you have a lower earning capacity?
With the same restrictions.
Second? Yeah, yeah. Actually, some of the restrictions were greater than the first.
So what should the court have done? What would the resolution be?
I think this case should be reversed and remanded for a determination as to the loss of earning power by utilizing apportionment. I think that the court should...
Or what about looking at all the restrictions at this point in time?
That's what apportionment would do. You have to look at the disability, not in a vacuum between the two separate injuries, but to look at this injured employee as a whole.
So there'd be one loss of earning instead of these two. Just from a practical standpoint, right, she awards two whole body, a 75%, a 55%. They're both going to run about 292 weeks, 288 weeks. Are they running concurrently? So she's going to get...
They could.
She's going to get two whole loss of earning.
Yes.
Concurrently, as long as the total amount stays under the statutory maximum, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. I don't know that... there would only be one loss of earning power. You know, I think there would have to be an analysis under apportionment. I think she would have to, the trial court would have to look at the first injury, and if she feels that that's a 75%, then she goes from there and says, do the restrictions assigned operate as a source of disability at the time of the second accident? Do they continue to operate as a source of disability at the time of the accident? And if they do, is there any additional disability from the second accident? And if there is, then there's potentially more loss of earning power.
Right.
Is that something, is that what the voc rehab person should have done?
The voc rehab person did do that. The voc rehab person assigned a, I believe it was a 60% on the first injury, and then the court adopted a 75%. And on the second injury, I think said 55%. But the vocational counselor did testify at trial, and she said that if you consider the restrictions in and of themselves, they do not, the second restrictions assigned to the back do not affect her employability whatsoever, do not affect her loss of earning power whatsoever.
So she gets zero for that?
Zero, because what she said was effectively outside of this plant, even after the first injury, she's unemployable. So it doesn't change after, you know, the second injury. Obviously, if you're unemployable after the first one, you're not employable after the second one.
Thank you, Pastor.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court. My name is Lee Loudon. Along with Joseph Huckleberry at council table, we represent the appellee, Helena Picard. The trial court made a factual finding that Ms. Picard sustained a 75% loss of earning power from her April 24, 2012 accident involving bilateral hand injuries, and a 55% loss of earning power as a result of the second accident on September 9, 2015 to her lower back. That factual finding is supported by the evidence and is not clearly wrong. The trial court also went on to apply penalties, interest, and attorney fees for appellee's failure to pay any permanent disability benefits whatsoever with regard to the September 9, 2015 accident to her back. Now, with respect to the finding that she sustained a 55% loss of earning power as a result of the second accident, the parties agreed to have a vocational counselor by the name of Kim Wren prepare a loss of earning power evaluation. And she gave an opinion that Ms. Picard's loss of earning power was between 50 and 55% based upon various scenarios concerning her average weekly wage. And that evidence is competent evidence that the trial court could rely upon in determining loss of earning power. The trial court was also empowered to rely upon Ms. Picard's self-described limitations. Ms. Picard testified that as a result of her back injury, she cannot walk more than a quarter mile. She loses her balance and falls. She has pain whenever she bends or twists her torso.
And these are more significant than the first injury. So why is her loss of earning in the second injury less than for the first injury, the bilateral carpal tunnel?
I think that the trial court may have determined that the 5-pound lifting restriction with regard to the carpal tunnel injury was more significant in determination of loss of earning power. And with regard to the first injury, I believe Ms. Picard was earning an average weekly wage of about $694 per week. And then as a result of the second accident, there was perhaps less of a wage loss. That may have been one of the factors, Judge Bishop.
So, you know, you heard my question earlier. Are these two loss of earning awards then to run concurrently and be paid concurrently up to the statutory maximum? And it looks like it'd be under it.
Yes, exactly. In 2005, the statutory maximum is set out, I believe, in 48-121.01, and every year the compensation court sends out this statutory maximum. For 2015, the statutory maximum was $761. Now, the combination of these two injuries does not meet the statutory maximum. The combination of the two injuries was $576.07. So that's why these benefits could be paid concurrently.
Now, wouldn't there be some retroactive effect with regard to the 2012 injury that would have to be caught up, so to speak, in light of this award?
Yes, and the benefits would be paid concurrently. They never exceeded the $761 maximum.
But in essence, though, an employee can receive 300 weeks for one injury and another 300 weeks for the second injury.
That's correct. And now, the trial court was careful to explain her decision under Martinez-Najaro versus IBP. She explained that under that decision, That decision involved a man who had sustained a shoulder injury and later a hernia injury. For the shoulder injury, he had a 34-pound lifting restriction. For the hernia, 30 pounds. And the trial court had determined the loss of earning power in Martinez-Najara should be based upon the 4-pound difference in the restrictions. And the Court of Appeals reversed and said, no, these are two distinct body parts. And the plaintiff, Martinez-Najara, had not been previously compensated for loss of earning power for the shoulder injury, and explained that for a shoulder injury, typically they're not analyzed as a loss of earning power, but rather as a scheduled member. That's like this case. As the trial court explained, we've got two different body parts here. The 2012 accident to Ms. Picard involved bilateral wrists. 2015 injury was to her low back. Now, accepting Appellee's position, they would say she has no loss of earning power whatsoever, even though she underwent surgery, weeks off work, and now is permanently restricted due to her back injury.
But she already had 75% loss of earning.
She did. Right. And right. And there was a question brought out about, well, now are you saying she has 130% loss of earning power? No. There's a case that the Court of Appeals discussed in Martinez-Najara versus IBP called Vega versus IBP, which explained that the benefits for two separate accidents can be paid concurrently so long as they do not exceed the statutory weekly maximum. That's exactly what we have here. In Vega versus IBP, there were successive injuries that resulted in some permanent disability, and then Vega, I believe, was on temporary disability. And one of the issues was, could IBP deduct from the temporary disability what they were paying out on permanent disability? And the Court of Appeals said no, that they can be paid concurrently. Otherwise, the claimant wouldn't be receiving compensation for both injuries. And that's what I'm saying here, is that the trial court was correct in analyzing it under Martinez-Najara, that we've got two separate accidents, two separate periods of disability, two separate earning power losses.
What's kind of unique here, though, is that, you know, we don't get the loss of earning on the scheduled members until the court issues its order, right? The court does that in its order. So back in 2012, for example, the payment would have been for scheduled members only, right? So I'm just trying to wrap my head around this idea of when you do a loss of earning, you're evaluating all the things that we've been talking about in what this person can now do. And why does that change? You know, I mean, it seems like there's another injury you do evaluate. Are there now new restrictions that are going to prevent greater access to the market or more limitations in the market? And what's weird about this is there was already a 75% loss of earning capacity, and now in the second injury, the court's saying there's only, what, 55% because of this injury. So with this injury, you're not considering that you already had 75% loss? You see what I'm saying? It's just kind of weird that it can, your loss of earning goes down in a second injury that creates more restriction.
Right. I understand your point, Judge. I think part of that greater loss of earning capacity, perhaps due to the 2012 accident, was again the greater wage loss that she had. I think, as I mentioned, it's around $694 in average weekly wage at that time. But I think to take the opposite position that she's not entitled to any loss of earning power whatsoever for the second accident is contrary to Vega versus IBP and several cases prior to that. I do want to jump ahead to the penalty issue to make one point.
Well, before you do that, yep. Answer this question. In yep. your view, when does apportionment apply?
Well, it can apply at the time of trial when the court has to determine whether the plaintiff has been previously compensated. In this instance, she had not been compensated. Now, the appellee could have paid her some compensation for the 2012 injury based on loss of earning power. They paid none. And then, at trial, they claimed that they should be entitled to apportionment, even though they had paid no loss of earnings for the 2012 accident.
They paid on the impairment, right?
They paid the impairment rate. That's a scheduled member.
Yeah.
Even though there was abundant evidence there was a loss of earning power.
So they were compensating?
Well, they compensated for the scheduled members, not as a loss of earning power.
Yeah.
And
they weren't under a duty at that time. They weren't under any duty at that time to pay under a loss of earning, were they?
The issue of whether or not there was a reasonable controversy with respect to the 2012 accident was not adjudicated. That's correct. But it was with regard to the 2015 accident. I just want to point out, for the 2015 accident, when the court cited Section 48-125 with regard to penalties, neither the appellee nor appellant let you know there's a change in Section 48-125 after trial. We should have let you know. I didn't. On July 19, 2018, LB 957 went into effect. It modified Section 48-125 in a procedural way, not substantive. The procedural change is that it said that now indemnity benefits and settlements can be paid electronically. That's the only change it made. It doesn't affect the outcome of this case. It just provides they can be paid electronically. One point that was made before is that these two injuries to Ms. Picard were to the same body part. They weren't. 2012 was the hands. 2015 was the back. Martinez-Najaro discusses how if in that case the injury to the shoulder, Martinez-Najaro, did not affect the hernia injury later, and the individual Martinez-Najaro would have sustained the hernia injury irrespective of that previous injury to the shoulder, and that's the same case here.
So in that case, did Martinez get a loss of earning capacity on the shoulder?
Not to my knowledge. I think it was paid out as a scheduled member.
Does that make a difference?
No, I don't think so. I think if the trial court correctly determined that you've got two separate injuries, two separate injuries to Ms. Picard's loss of earning ability, and she should be compensated as such under the previous case I talked about, Vega versus IBP. In Vega, you've got the same a similar situation that you've got temporary disability and permanent disability to be paid concurrently.
Do you think apportionment only applies when it stems from the same injury or the same body part or either?
No, same body part.
Same body part. Yeah. So if there's different body parts, it should never apply? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think it should. Cummings versus Omaha Public Schools is the case I think you're referring to, where the Cummings had successive back injuries, and this court said that there should be apportionment. But that's involved when Cummings had been previously compensated, number one, and number two, same body part, the low back.
Okay, so let me throw a little twist into this, what's going on in this case.
Okay.
Let's say, you know, your client develops a psychological injury that's then going to be decided on a loss of earning, right? Assuming that that's determined. Does that get apportioned?
Would the loss of earning stem from one of these previous compensated accidents?
Yes, it would, right?
Well, it wouldn't be separately compensated. First of all, we'd have to file a petition to modify under Section 48-141 and to show an increasing incapacity due solely and only to the original injury.
Then, or both? Or both of them?
Perhaps both of them. Mm-hmm. And then we'd have to show both an increase in the, under Brunzinski versus Model Electric, the elements would be, would have to prove an increase in the impairment rating, the number two, to modify, an increase in the loss of earning capacity. If the claimant could get over those hurdles, perhaps so there would be another an increase in the loss of earning capacity.
Yeah. So it really wouldn't be apportionment, it'd just be a modification of the loss.
Correct, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm sorry I'm out of time.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. It's very helpful.
All right. How much time did we have left? Okay. So I think we should allot an opportunity for you to respond to that since he went over by 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Do you have anything you'd like to address?
The only thing I'd like to address is Mr. Loudon's point about the Cummings case, in that those are two of the same injuries. It was a back and a back. And I'm just wondering how far into the analysis is this court going to get in terms of whole body injuries? That case didn't say it was an L2 injury, an L3 injury, an L4 injury, an S1 injury. It just said a back and a back. And I think what the court was trying to get at was that it's a whole body injury and another whole body injury. If you were to read Cummings verbatim and that you have to have the exact same specific injury, then I think you'd have to have court decisions that really outline they had an L2 fracture that was fused at this level, and then the next injury was an L3 herniation, and so those are separate injuries, and those are not entitled to apportionment either. I think the distinction between the Martinez-Navarro case and the distinction between the Cummings case is the scheduled member versus the whole body injury. And in this case, we have a whole body injury and a whole body injury. And leading into the penalty issue, as Justice Bishop correctly analyzed, under 48.121 sub 3, there was no obligation by the defendants and no knowledge of the defendants that the athlete had met the 48.121 sub 3 requirement that she suffered at least a 30% disability. So until there was that judicial determination that she went over the 30% threshold, there was no obligation on the, and there was actually no entitlement by the athlete to additional benefits. And again, that leads into the penalty situation and the apportionment situation, because apportionment is most applicable when injuries occur close in time to each other. So, you know, if an injury happens in 1997 and then another injury happens in 2007, it's highly likely that the injury from 2007 is no longer acting as a source of disability. But if an injury happens in 2012 and then you've got another injury that happens in 2015, it's highly likely that that's the type of case in which the first injury is going to be acting as a source of disability. That, leading into the penalty issue, is that there was clearly a reasonable controversy about whether or not benefits were due and owing.
Thank you.
Thanks, Your Honor.
The matter is submitted. Thank you, Counsel.